eyes. It trickles down inside my t-shirt and along the backs of my knees. But I keep pedaling. Past the Conoco station, past the golf course, up the hill, until I come to an area of tall pine trees. I pull off the road and lean the bicycle against a tree. I make my way through the woods until I come to a beautiful canyon. I am still amazed at the scenery here. I half expect to hear hoofbeats in the distance, and then to see a cowboy thundering into view riding a slick black stallion. I sit on a rock at the very edge of the canyon, hugging my knees and looking down. The rock juts out and makes me feel I could fly right off it. How quickly everything can change, I think. One minute you're alive and the next you could be dead. There isn't any way to know what's going to happen. If this rock comes loose, I'll fall, I think. Fall to the bottom of the canyon. Will I fall straight down, I wonder? Or kind of float down, gently? Either way, my head will smash open and my bones will break. How long will it be before I am found? Days, weeks, a month? Maybe I'll never be found. Then the buzzards will pick at my flesh until there is nothing left of me. Nothing but bones. Broken bones. I shake that image from my mind and concentrate on the beauty of the canyon. I think about being at the bottom, surrounded by it. I am tempted to climb down, but then I remember Bitsy's story about the 14-year-old boy who was killed by a falling rock while he was climbing in a canyon, and about the woman who tripped and fell, breaking her leg. By the time she was found, she was in shock and didn't make it. Bitsy and Walter are full of stories about what might happen. They don't believe in taking chances. They will probably live to be 100. I decide to climb down anyway. I don't know whether to go backwards, hanging on to the rocks, or to try walking down frontwards. I combine the two methods and get going. Down, down I climb, rock after rock, losing my footing every now and then, grabbing hold of a branch to steady myself. Down, down, traveling over the steepest inclines on my backside. Down, down. I don't know how long it takes me. Half an hour? An hour? I've left my watch at home, knowing that today there is no schedule to follow. That today is mine. Down, down, into the bottom of the canyon. I look up now, surprised at how far I have come, and for a second, I remember that I will have to climb back up. That I shouldn't go too far. Then, I'm distracted by a lizard. How perfectly he blends into his surroundings. I stand there and watch as he scampers from rock to rock. I stretch out on a rock myself, lifting my face to the sun, and a feeling comes over me. A feeling of wanting to share all of this with my father. I want to talk with him so badly I ache. I want to tell him how I climbed down into the canyon by myself, that I wasn't afraid. I want to tell him everything, everything that has happened since that night, everything I am thinking and feeling. I wish I could feel his kiss on my forehead again, light and loving. I wish I could feel his hand smoothing my hair away from my face. His hands were so big enough to palm a basketball. Big enough to hold Jason in the air. I remember how warm it felt to be near him. How safe. Suppose it's all been a mistake, I think. Suppose he's not dead at all. That when we get back to Atlantic City, he'll be there, working in the store. And he'll say, "Well, well, if it isn't Davy Wexler." And I'll say, "In the flesh." And then we'll laugh. And I will never be too busy to go walking on the beach with him, or to help him in the store, or just to sit quietly at his side again. Oh, Daddy, please don't be dead. Please. And then it hits me. The realization that I'll never be with him again. Never. That he isn't coming back. You have to face reality, Davy. You have to accept the facts. I sit up and cup my hands around my mouth. "Daddy!" I call. I hear my echo around the canyon. "Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!" I stand up and call louder.
Can you hear me, Daddy? Can you?
Then I hear a voice, answering mine, and it isn't my echo.
Hey! Hey down there!
It calls. I spin around trying to find it.
Hey! Are you all right?
I catch a glimpse of him. He is standing halfway up the canyon and is partly hidden by a tree.
Who? Me?
I ask, as if it might be someone else.
Yeah, you!
He calls as he begins to climb down. I shade my eyes from the sun and see that he is very sure-footed. He is not slipping or sliding or falling the way I did. He reaches the bottom quickly and comes toward me. He is about 19 or 20, wearing faded cutoffs, hiking boots with wool socks sticking out over the tops and no shirt. He has a knapsack on his back. He is maybe 5'9", with suntanned skin and dark hair.
I thought you were in trouble, he says. The way you were calling.
His eyes are dark brown. No, I say. I'm fine.
What are you doing down here?
He sounds less friendly now.
Thinking, I tell him. Is there a law against that?
The truth is, I am scared out of my mind. My heart is pounding. Suppose he's a crazy, I think. Suppose he's a rapist or worse. If he is, I'm in for it. I have to prepare myself. There's no way I'm going to let him take me by surprise. I know what to do. I'll smash his head in with a rock. A rock! I have to find the right rock. I scan the ground and see a good one not 10 feet away. I move toward it, slowly, wishing I had my bread knife with me.
No law against thinking, he says. Except that you're alone.
He's probably a junkie. He probably comes to the canyon to shoot up, I think. Or to trip, or just to get stoned. So? I'm alone, I say, sounding bitchier by the minute. Is there a law against that? I am standing right in front of the rock now. All I have to do is bend over, pick it up, and wham.
No, but there should be, he says.
Oh, yeah?
Why?
I am having trouble following our conversation, but I know it is best to keep him talking. The longer he talks, the less likely that he'll attack. I read that somewhere.
Who's going to get help if you need it?
He asks me. I think that's an interesting question coming from him. I keep my eye on the rock. Every muscle in my body is tensed and ready to spring into action if necessary.
Suppose you trip and fall? He begins.
Suppose you do. You're alone too, aren't you? Yes, that's good. Put some fear into him. Let him think that maybe I'm the crazy, waiting to pounce on him in the silence of the canyon.
I've had plenty of experience, he says.
And how do you know I haven't? Then he laughs. His teeth are very white against his suntanned skin.
You don't know your ass from your armpit, he says.
Elbow, I think. He means elbow.
Listen, macho man, I say, looking him in the eye. Buzz off.
I sound really tough.
But all he does is laugh again. Are you always so bitchy?
No, I say. Just when I feel like it.
You're new around here.
He says this is a statement, not a question.
So what if I am? Hey, relax. I'm not going to bite you. All I'm trying to say is next time, bring a friend. It's safer that way.
I don't have any friends.
Find some, he tells me.
He bends over and I panic, thinking that he is going for my rock, that he is going to use it on me. But all he does is pick up a handful of stones. He jiggles them around in his hand. Then, without looking at me, he says,
Who are you so pissed off at anyway?
The world, I tell him, without even thinking about it. I am surprised by my answer to his question and by the anger in my voice. It is the first time I realize I am not only sad about my father, but angry too.
angry that he had to die, and angry at whoever killed him. He sits down on a rock, opens his knapsack, and pulls out a bottle of water. I watch as he takes a swig. I'm so thirsty I can hardly stand it. The inside of my mouth is dried out. My tongue feels thick and furry. I would do anything for a drink of water. He must sense this because he looks at me and says,
"You're thirsty."
"A little," I tell him, licking my parched lips. "You came into the canyon without a water bottle?" "I forgot it," I lie. "It's home." "Here." He passes his to me. I am so relieved, I feel like crying. I mean to take a quick swig, but once it's to my lips, I can't stop. I drink and drink until he takes it from me. "Easy," he says, "or you'll get sick." I begin to relax. He's not out to get me after all. "What's your name?" I ask him.
"You can call me Wolf."
"Is that a first name or a last name?"
"Either,"
he says. "Oh." I can't think of anything else to say. He stands, puts the water bottle back into his knapsack, stretches and says,
"Okay, let's go."
"Go?" I shouldn't have let down my guard. "Where?"
"Back up," he says. "It's 1 o'clock. I've got an appointment at 2.
"So go," I tell him.
"You're going with me."
"Really?" I say.
"Yeah, really."
"Guess again," I say.
"I'm not about to leave you down here by yourself. I'm not in the mood to be called by search and rescue later. I have other things to do."
"Search and rescue?" "Right." I think about the 14-year-old boy who was killed by a falling rock, and about the woman who broke her leg and went into shock, and I wonder if Wolf was called in then. But I don't ask him. Instead, I say, "I'm tougher than I look."
"Sure you are. Let's go."
"I'm in a hurry."
"How do I know I can trust you?"
"You see anybody you can trust more?"
I look around. He begins to walk away. I decide to follow him. He climbs quickly. I try to step exactly where he does. After a while, I ask him if he goes to school around here. He doesn't answer. I say it again, louder.
"You go to school around here, Wolf?"
"The more you talk, the harder time you're going to have climbing," he says without turning around.
"Okay," I think. "So I'm having trouble keeping up. So I'm breathing hard. So I'm a little out of shape. So what?" I don't say any of this. Instead, I watch the muscles in his legs. I notice how brown and smooth the skin is on his back, how his hair hangs just past the nape of his neck, how narrow his hips are, how strong his arms and shoulders look. As if he knows what I'm thinking, he turns.
"How are you doing?"
"Okay, just fine. I told you, I'm tough." I wipe the sweat off my face with the back of my hand. Wolf turns and begins to climb again. I follow him, then trip on a rock and skin my knee. I feel like crying out, but I don't. I have to hurry to catch up with him. He doesn't seem to notice. Finally, we reach the top, and Wolf walks me to my bicycle and then out to the road. I wonder if I will have the strength to ride home. Then I remember that it will be almost all downhill. Wolf leans against a tree, chewing on a piece of grass.
"Well, thanks," I say. "Thanks for the water and the guided tour."
He nods. We are both quiet for a minute. Then he says,
"Get yourself a decent pair of boots. Adidas are okay for tennis, not rock climbing.
And next time, bring a water bottle." I get on my bicycle.
"What's your name?"
he asks me, as I am about to pedal away. I think for a minute before answering. When I do, I face him and say,
"You can call me Tiger."
"Is that a first name or a last name?"
he asks.
"Neither,"
I say. And this time, I do pedal away. I know that he's watching me, but I don't turn around. I can hear him laughing. And I laugh too.
Chapter 10.
At home, I gobble up the chicken sandwich Bitsy has left for me. Then I take a hot shower. I am stiff and sore all over, but I feel good. I begin to sing. I sing song after song, glad that no one is home to hear me or see how much hot water I am using. I shampoo my hair. I scrub between each toe, and all the time I am singing. I think about quitting school and trying for a singing career. I can see it now. My name in lights on a revolving sign outside the resort's International Hotel and Casino. Inside, the MC announces my debut.
Ladies and gentlemen, presenting Atlantic City's own Davey Wexler.
The drums roll. I step out on stage wearing this long, slinky black dress, slit up one side, my hair flowing down my back, a rose tucked behind my ear. I pick up the microphone, and the room gets so quiet, you can hear the snap of my fingers as I begin to sing in this husky, sexy voice that is nothing like the soprano I am in chorus. My mother sits out front, at the best table with Jason, Linnea, and Hugh, sipping champagne. Across the room, at a table by himself, is Wolf. I can't take my eyes off him. It seems I am singing every song just for him. When I finish, the audience goes wild, yelling, "Encore! Encore!" I sing two more songs. After, Wolf rushes up to the stage and presents me with a bouquet of roses, dozens of them, pure white. My mother and Jason, Linnea, and Hugh are all wondering who this stranger is. This stranger who is obviously so crazy about Davey. Chapter 11. While I am drying off, I begin to think about the shower I'd taken on the night my father was killed. I was sandy from the beach, and it was so hot and sticky that even the cool shower didn't help much. The window air conditioner in the living room was on full blast, and in both back bedrooms, fans were whirring. We had just one small lamp on, though, trying to conserve some energy because the whole East Coast had been warned of a possible brownout. Jason was racing around in his bathing suit and Dracula cape, fighting an imaginary war with his model airplanes.
Wham! Got you. Pow, pow, pow! Got you back.
Hurry up, Jace, my mother called. Get into some clothes or we'll miss the sale. She was taking Jason to the jean machine. They were running a pre-season special on back-to-school clothes.
Davey, would you zip me up?
Mom asked, knocking on my bedroom door. I flipped over my Bruce Springsteen tape and danced across the room to the door. Mom, tall, slim, and barefooted, backed into my room. I zipped her white sundress and fastened the little hook on top. She was carrying her sandals, and her wet hair hung loose around her shoulders. She smelled of ivory soap and baby powder. My hair was dripping down my back, and I still had only a bath towel wrapped around me while I tried to decide what to put on to go walking with Hugh.
Your nose is peeling again, Mom said.
I touched it.
I know.
Keep it covered with zinc for a couple of days. Give it a chance to clear up.
Zinc's disgusting. I'd rather peel.
We should be back by 10, Mom said, forgetting about my nose.
Unless we stop for ice cream.
But by 11 at the latest.
Okay.
She checked her watch. It was pink gold, with a tiny ruby on each side of the face, a raised crystal and a narrow gold-linked band. It belonged to my grandmother, who died 15 years ago, right before I was born. Mom has had plenty of experience in dealing with death. Her father died when she was still in high school, and her brother died when he was 19. So she named me Davis, because there was no one else to carry on her family name.
Jason, will you please put something on?
Mom said again. She turned back to me.
Don't stay out too late. I'd rather have you bring Hugh back here. It's a lot safer than the beach.
As soon as Mom and Jason left, I closed the door to my bedroom, and as I got dressed, I chatted with Minka.
What we have here, Minka, I said, pulling on my favorite jeans, is pure physical attraction. Physical attraction.
You know what that means? It means it feels good to be near Hugh. Really good. When he holds my hand, my insides flip over. Did you ever feel that way, Minka? Did some boy cat ever rub up against you and make you feel wonderful? Minka, who had been bathing, looked up. I scratched her under her chin, then put on my new halter. Well, don't you worry, I said. It's never too late. Minka gave me a big yawn. I sprayed myself with Charlie, checked myself in the mirror, and ran downstairs to the store to wait for Hugh. My father was at his easel, working on a portrait. There were no customers. He had the radio tuned in to WFLN, the classical music station. Hi, I said, helping myself to a peppermint candy from the glass bowl on the checkout counter. The sign on the bowl read, Help the retarded, 2 for a quarter. My father opened the cash register, took out a quarter and dropped it into the bank behind the box. Then he looked at me. Well, well, well. If it isn't Davy Wexler. In the flesh, I said. So I see, Dad said, eyeing my skimpy halter. I felt my cheeks turn red. I walked behind the counter to where Dad was sitting at his easel and looked over his shoulder. Very nice, I said. Especially the eyes. I wish I could draw like you. You can do other things. Oh, yeah? Like what? My father pretended to think that over. You're very good at stacking the bread, he said. Thanks a lot. We both laughed. I hung my arms over his shoulders from behind and rested my face against his hair, which was soft and curly and smelled of salt water. So, where are you off to? Dad asked. Oh, you and I are going out. What time will you be back? I'm not sure. An educated guess? 10, 11, something like that. Stay off the beach. It's not safe at night.
I've already had the lecture.
I just don't want you to get carried away and forget.
I won't, I promise.
Well, I can't ask for more than that.
Hugh came into the store then, wearing his Grateful Dead t-shirt and jeans.
Hi, everybody, he said.
Have you heard the one about the man who gave his cat a bath?
Stop, Dad said.
I've heard it 2 dozen times. From you.
Hugh walked up to the counter and took 2 mints, dropping a quarter into the bank.
Ready?
He asked me.
Ready. Bye, Dad. See you later.
Bye, Dad said. Have a nice time, and don't be too late.
Don't worry, Mr. Wexler, Hugh said.
Outside, the sun was setting. Chapter 12.
Stop, I tell myself. Stop thinking about that night. Concentrate on how good it feels to be alive, no matter what. Just to see the color of the sky, to smell the pine trees, to meet a stranger in the canyon. I go to my room, tear a piece of paper from the yellow pad on my dresser, and write 1 word, alive. Then I tear off another piece and write, wolf. I get pleasure from seeing my hand form the letters. I write it in all caps, wolf. I write it in all lowercase letters, wolf. I spell it backwards, flow. I'm surprised to find that it spells a word. Davy and wolf, wolf and Davy. I open the trunk at the foot of the bed and place both pieces of paper inside it, on the paisley lining. Then I decide to put my Angora sweater set in there too, on top of the papers, and my fisherman's pullover. Also the letter from Linnea, which she wrote and mailed on the day we left Atlantic City. And then, the bread knife. I've been hiding it under my bed every morning, but if Bitsy decides to vacuum and moves the bed, she'll find it. And that will mean questions and more questions. Better to keep it in the trunk during the day and to take it out only at night, when I might need it. At dinner, Mom asks me how my day was. Very interesting, I tell her. I see Bitsy raise her eyebrows.
And relaxing.
I add, hoping to avoid any questions. How was Cochiti Lake?
Very nice, Mom says. Walter explained the whole history of the area to us.
I'll bet he did, I think.
It's a man-made lake, Jason says, and it's big enough to sail a boat.
A small boat, Walter says.
A small boat, Jason repeats.
You missed a nice day, Davy,
Bitsy tells me. I hide my smile in a glass of milk. Later, I sit with Jason on the deck. We snuggle together in one lounge chair, stargazing. The sky is so clear here that without any trouble, I can make out the Dipper. I am able to find Cassiopeia, too. Walter is so impressed with what he considers my interest in astronomy that he has given me a book, The Beginner's Guide to Stars and Planets.
Look, Jason, I say. There's Cygnus, the swan. Can you make out the neck? The wings?
I think so, Jason says, yawning.
I want to.
Impulsively, I hug him.
Watch it,
he says.
Chapter 13. Two nights before we are due to fly home, the phone rings. Walter answers. It is Audrey, my mother's friend from Atlantic City. She probably wants to pick us up at the airport, Mom says, taking the call in the kitchen. But when she comes back to the living room, her face is deadly pale.
The store has been attacked by vandals, she says quietly. They shot out the windows and the inside is a mess. They smashed everything they could get their hands on. Who would do such a terrible thing to us? I think. What have we ever done to anybody?
The police have no leads, Mom continues, but they don't think it's related to the robbery.
To the... Her voice trails off. She manages to say, to the last time, before she covers her face with her hands. The room is filled with the sound of a long, low wail. It sends shivers down my back. I look around trying to identify it, then realize it is coming from my mother.
Damn them, she screams. Damn them to hell.
I know how she feels. I want to comfort her, to hold her close the way she held me when Jason had his nosebleed. But she is hysterical now, raving and ranting around the room, pulling at her own hair, screaming and crying and flinging aside whatever is in her way. Needlepoint cushions fly into the air. A stack of books is swept off the table with one movement of her arm. An amber glass ashtray smashes against the fireplace. Jason stands in front of the grandfather clock, his hands over his ears. I can tell he is afraid. I am frightened too. But even more, I am surprised. I've never seen my mother lose control. Not the night my father was killed. Not at his funeral. Not ever. Until now. Mom knocks over a lamp. I wait for Walter or Bitsy to stop her. Why are they just standing there like zombies? Why doesn't somebody do something? But then Mom kicks the wall with her bare foot and cries out in pain. She has hurt herself. The shock is enough to stop her. She begins to cry. But now it is a different kind of crying. She collapses against Bitsy, who takes her in her arms.
I'm sorry, Mom whimpers. I'm sorry, but I just can't take anymore. I just can't.
Mommy, Jason runs to her.
Mommy, don't do that again.
I won't, Mom says, holding him close. I just couldn't help myself this time. She looks over at me. I look back, trying to let her know I understand without saying a word. Three of Mom's toes turn blue and swollen. Bitsy gets an ice pack. Mom yelps when Walter tries to touch her foot. They discuss whether or not they should go to the emergency room for x-rays. They decide against it.
There's nothing to do for broken toes but tape them together, Bitsy says.
She once took a first aid course and this is what she learned. Besides, Mom doesn't want to go. She's embarrassed. But the next day, the pain is worse.
and Bitsy takes Mom for x-rays anyway. Two of the toes are broken. The doctor tapes them together. Bitsy is pleased that her treatment was correct. Mom hobbles around in a pair of old tennis shoes with a hole cut out for her toes. She can't decide what to do about the store. She can't decide what to do about anything. Walter and Bitsy convince her to stay a while longer. "I'll take care of everything," Walter promises. The next morning, I walk down to Central Avenue and buy two postcards in TG and Y. One shows an aerial view of Los Alamos. "Greetings from the Atomic City" is printed across it. This one I will send to Linnea. The other is a photo of Camel Rock at sunset. This one is for Hugh. I cross the street and go to the post office, where I write messages on each of the cards. "Hi, future scientist," I write to Linnea. And then I can't think of anything else I want to say. So I write in big letters, "Lots to tell you. See you soon." I address the Camel Rock card to Hugh and write, "Did you hear about the store? It's the last straw. I don't know when we're coming home now." I mail the cards, then remember I haven't signed either one of them. Oh well, they'll know they are from me. I decide to go to the library since it is next to the post office. I browse around, picking a book off the bestseller shelves, skimming it, then putting it back. I don't see anything I want to read. Nothing interests me. I'm having trouble concentrating, except on my star book. I'm able to memorize what I read in that. Outside, I pass a shoe store and in the window is a pair of hiking boots. They are on sale for $32.50, marked down from $59.95. I go in and ask to try them on. The saleswoman tells me they are a very good buy and asks what size I wear. 8, I tell her. 8 narrow. She goes into the back room and comes out carrying a big box, which she sets down on the floor. She whips off the cover and holds one boot up. "Vibram soles," she says. "The real McCoy." I nod as if I understand. When she sees that I am wearing my Adidas barefooted, she reaches over for a basket filled with socks. "Let's see," she says, rummaging through it. "We want to see how they fit with heavy socks. Wool would be best." She shakes out a heavy gray sock. "Put this on, dear, and we'll see how they fit." It is the same kind of sock Wolf was wearing. I pull it onto my left foot because I know that that one is slightly bigger than my right. The saleswoman helps me into the boot. It is stiff. She laces it up and tells me to stand. "How does that feel?" she asks. "I can't tell," I say. "I think I should try on the other one too." She looks in the basket for a matching sock. There is none. Instead, she hands me a pink knitted sock. I pull it on, wondering whose sock it was. I think about a girl my age, taking off her pink sock to try on a pair of summer shoes, then forgetting it. Maybe that's how it wound up in the stray sock basket. I get up and walk around in both boots, feeling as if my feet are encased in cement. "You have to break them in," the saleswoman says. "Wear them around the house, wear them to school. Get them nice and comfortable before you wear them hiking." I turn around in front of the mirror. "A terrific buy," she tells me again. "And you can weatherproof the suede. It will turn the color darker, but I think they look even nicer that way." The feet I am looking at in the mirror seem to belong to someone else. They don't look like my feet at all. "And the sale ends this Saturday," she reminds me. But she doesn't have to worry. I have already made up my mind. I made it up the minute I saw them in the window. "I'll take them," I tell her. "And I'd like a pair of wool socks." "Certainly, dear. White or gray?" "Gray." "And a bottle of Snow Seal so you can weatherproof them right away?" she asks, reaching up to a shelf lined with Snow Seals. "Yes." "And will that be all?" "Yes." "Cash or charge?" "Cash," I say, opening my wallet. I have exactly $74.68 saved up for my summer job.
I worked as a beach girl at the Park Place Hotel, handing out towels and carrying chairs for guests. I was paid in tips. On a good day, I could pocket $15. I had planned to blow it all on a back-to-school shopping spree. Once I was shopping in Bamberger's with my mother, and I saw this girl piling up sweaters and skirts and jeans and shirts. I couldn't take my eyes off that pile. And I guess she noticed, because she turned to me and smiled. "I'm going away to college," she said, as if she had to explain. And I just smiled back and thought about what it must be like to have so much money that you can buy whatever you want, more, much more than you need. And that's what I'd planned to do with my $74.68. Although, I knew I wouldn't get much of a pile. I hand my money to the saleswoman, who never stops smiling. "Thank you, dear," she says. Normally, I'm put off by anyone who calls people dear. Yet she sounds as if she really means it, and looks as if she is glad I came in and bought the hiking boots. She isn't just putting it on. Maybe it's because I am the only customer. Maybe business is slow this fall. Who knows? On the way home, I am hit with the guilties. What will my mother say? "A waste? What are you going to do with hiking boots in Atlantic City, Davy? Did you think it over carefully, or was it just impulse buying? You know how hard it is to make ends meet, and especially now with Daddy..." Never mind. I won't show them to my mother, or to anyone else. They will be my secret. All I can think of is going to the canyon, finding Wolf, and showing him my hiking boots. Actually, all I can think about is going to the canyon and finding Wolf. I want to see if being around him still makes me feel glad to be alive. I want to go this afternoon, right after lunch, but Bitsy has other plans. We haven't been to the Bradbury Science Museum yet. She is a volunteer guide there every Wednesday. And since this is Wednesday, we will all go together. Bitsy wears a red jacket with a name tag that says, "Elizabeth Kronick, Guide." She wears black pants and a white shirt with a black string tie. She explains that there is no official uniform for guides at the museum, but that this is what she wears every week. It makes her feel official. I am not too hot on going to the science museum, but Jason can't wait. We walk over. It is another beautiful afternoon. The air is clear, the sky is a perfect blue color, the sun warming. Yet through it, you can feel just a hint of fall. My mother limps a little, but her toes aren't giving her that much trouble. She doesn't say much. I hope she's going to be okay. I hope she's not going to explode again. Bitsy whisks us through the museum and out to a courtyard, where there are replicas of the atom bomb. There is a sign saying, "Displayed here are ballistic cases like those of the two atomic bombs detonated over Japan in August 1945, the only atomic weapons ever used in warfare. Each was the equivalent of about 20,000 tons of TNT. The result of 27 months of unprecedented effort by thousands of scientists and technicians, they represent one of the greatest scientific achievements of all time. Both bombs were designed, fabricated, and assembled at Los Alamos." Jason is really turned on by the bombs. He runs his hand along the surface of one called Little Boy, which was dropped on Hiroshima. "And they were invented here? In Los Alamos?" "That's right," Bitsy tells him. "And they killed a lot of people?" "Yes." "How many people did this bomb kill?"
"A lot," Bitsy says.
"Hundreds?" Jason asks.
"Yes."
"Thousands?"
"Yes, I don't know the exact numbers." I think it's peculiar for a guide not to be able to answer Jason's question. Maybe it is that she doesn't want to answer him.
"Does Uncle Walter make bombs?" Jason asks.
"Uncle Walter doesn't make them," Bitsy says. "He's involved in designing and research."
"He is?" I say. "For bombs?"
"For weapons in general," Bitsy says. "I had no idea," I say. "You know Uncle Walter is a group leader in W Division," Bitsy says proudly.
But I don't know what W Division is, I say.
It's the weapons division, Bitsy tells me. Half of the lab is involved in weapons research, and the other half is involved in basic research. Medicine, energy.
Bitsy is ticking off a list, but I have tuned her out. I am thinking of Walter instead. I can't picture him designing bombs. I always thought a person who designs weapons would be hard and cruel. A kind of wild-eyed mad scientist, intent on blowing up the world. But Walter is so ordinary. I just can't get over the fact that he is somehow involved in building bombs, in killing people.
A tourist couple asks if they can take a picture of Jason, standing next to the replica of the bomb called Fat Boy. The bomb we dropped on Nagasaki. Jason poses and smiles. That night while we are having dinner, my mother develops an intense headache. It's been coming on all day, she tells us, excusing herself from the table. Maybe that's why she was so quiet in the museum this afternoon. She didn't say three words. I think I'd better take some aspirin and go to bed, she says.
You'll feel better in the morning, Bitsy calls after her.
It's probably just the altitude.
The altitude is Bitsy's excuse for every problem. But I am not thinking about my mother or her intense headache. I am still thinking about Walter. I look at him differently now. I feel myself tensing up, growing more hostile toward him by the minute. As if he can read my mind, he leans across the table and says, Davy, what's wrong?
Nothing, I manage to say.
Oh, yes. He gives me a scrutinizing look. I can tell. Something is wrong.
Well, I begin. It's just that I can't believe you designed weapons.
Oh, so that's it.
Yes, I'm surprised.
It's my job, he says, and I do it as well as I can.
Couldn't you find another job? I ask.
That's not the point.
What is?
We're in this business to design the best weapons we can, so that no one will ever think they can win a war against us.
That doesn't make any sense.
Think of us as watchdogs, Davy, making sure that no one will ever attack us. But if they do, we'll be ready. And being ready is more than half the battle.
But if nobody made bombs in the first place...
I wish it could be that way.
Why can't it?
Because that's not the way of the world.
It should be.
You're right, Walter says, but it's not.
Later, when I am in bed, I try to think of Walter as a watchdog. But the only picture I get in my mind is of a German shepherd or a Doberman named Walter. I imagine Walter sitting at his desk at the lab, thinking up new ways to kill people. Walter, who hoses down the blazer every time he drives it off the hill. Walter, who helps clear away the dinner plates. Walter, who reads Jason a chapter from Stuart Little every night. I tuck the bread knife under my pillow and sleep with one hand wrapped around it. Chapter 14. The next day I sneak my hiking boots down to the garage and bury one in each of Bitsy's canvas bike bags. I find a canteen on a shelf, rinse it, and fill it with water. When I go back to the house, Jason is sitting on the living room floor playing dominoes, and Mom is stretched out on the sofa, twirling a rubber band around her fingers. Bitsy is in the kitchen. She tells me that she is going to a bridge party and will be gone for lunch.
Do you want me to make you a sandwich before I leave? She asks.
No, don't worry about me. I'm going out for my exercise.
If I put it that way, Bitsy doesn't object. She and Walter are very big on exercise. Walter jogs every day at noon, and Bitsy leaves the house every morning at 8 for a brisk walk around the block with her friends. So there is no problem as long as I promise to wear the helmet and to ride facing traffic.
Where do you go, Davy?
Bitsy asks, as she covers a freshly baked apple pie with aluminum foil.
Oh, around, I say. I like to explore.
Just be careful,
and don't take any chances.
Me? Take chances?
I picture myself climbing down into the canyon.
Don't worry, I don't take chances.
Good, Bitsy says.
I'm glad to hear it.
This family has had enough trouble.
You bet, I say.
Bitsy gives me a strange look as I say goodbye to Mom and Jason. Maybe I haven't used her favorite expression in the right way. When I reach the wooded area near the canyon, I lean my bike against a tree, sling the canteen over my shoulder, and exchange my Adidas for my boots, which are weatherproofed and ready for action. Then I traipse around in the woods, trying to get used to them. I walk in circles, alternately stomping, skipping, and jumping, then laughing because I feel so silly. Finally, I head for the canyon. I look down and hope I will see Wolf, but there is no one in sight. I sit for a while, thinking about Atlantic City and the beach. I used to go walking on the beach every day, winter and summer. It was my time alone, my time for thinking. Often I'd sit on a jetty, and before I knew it, an hour or more had passed. This canyon reminds me of the jetty and the beach. It is a good place to be alone, a good place for my thoughts. I see someone moving below me. I stand up to get a better look. It is Wolf, making his way down into the canyon.
Hey, I call. Hey down there.
He turns, but he can't see me. His eyes are blinded by the sun.
You must be new around here, I shout. I'll bet you don't know your ass from your armpit.
He moves away so that he is out of the sun's direct rays. He looks up and around. Still, he hasn't seen me.
Suppose you get hurt, I say. Who's going to call the search and rescue team?
I wave my arms like crazy until I am sure he has spotted me. He laughs then, and his laugh echoes through the canyon. I scamper down to where he is standing, losing my balance just once. Wolf looks me over and nods.
I see you found your canteen, he says.
Uh-huh.
And got yourself a pair of hiking boots.
Uh-huh.
Very good.
He leads the way and together we climb down into the canyon. By the time we get there, my right boot is making a blister across the heel of my foot. I should have brought some band-aids with me. At the bottom, we sit on a rock and watch the lizards racing around. Minka would be very happy down here, I think. She would love to chase lizards. But Walter has told me stories about coyotes who live in the canyons and how they carry cats away. I would never take a chance with Minka. Wolf opens his knapsack. He offers me fruit and cheese. I take an orange and a piece of cheddar.
You have sad eyes, Tiger, he says.
A bright smile, but sad eyes. He waits for me to say something. I don't.
You want to talk about it? He asks.
No. Okay. We sit quietly for a moment. Maybe someday, I tell him. Maybe someday I'll tell you about it.
Okay,
he says. But not today. Whenever, he says. I nod. That night, I catch hell from Bitsy. She saw me riding back from the canyon, and I wasn't wearing my helmet.
I guess I forgot it, I say sheepishly.
Safety first, Davy, Bitsy says. Just don't forget it again. We're trying to take good care of you, but you've got to help us. What does she mean by that? I can take care of myself. But I know that from now on, I will have to be more careful, or she won't let me ride the bicycle. On the first Saturday in October, we leave the house at 6 a.m. to drive down to Albuquerque to see the balloons take off at the annual hot air balloon festival. On the way, we stop at Dunkin' Donuts in Santa Fe and stuff ourselves on honey-glazed crullers. Jason convinces Bitsy to buy him a box of munchkins for the road. We get to Albuquerque just before 8 a.m. and line up with hundreds of other cars to watch as the balloons fill the sky with brilliant colors. Jason and I sit on the hood of the Blazer.
Would you go up in one, Davy? Jason asks.
In a minute, I say. It's beautiful to watch,
Bitsy says. But only a fool would actually participate.
Well, I'd do it, I tell her.
Then so would I, Jason says.
There's no point in arguing over whether you would or you wouldn't, Walter says. It's a moot question.
What's moot? Jason asks.
It means it doesn't matter because it isn't going to happen, Walter tells him.
Oh, Jason says. I like to go up and never come down, Mom says. We all look at her. What does she mean, never come down? On the way home, I promise myself that someday I will go up in a hot air balloon. I picture myself taking off. I wave at the crowd as it grows smaller and smaller, until the people watching are just tiny dots on the earth, while I am floating in my own world of sky and clouds and quiet. By the time we get halfway home, my mother has developed another headache, even worse than the last one. Bitsy tells her to close her eyes and try to sleep. Jason babbles on about the balloons. He is full of questions about how they work. Bitsy tells him that there are accidents almost every year, that something always goes wrong. I read the paper carefully all week, and if anything has gone wrong with one of the balloons, I can't find a story about it. My mother has three more headaches in a row. She says they come on suddenly, like a blinding white light piercing her eyes. After the third one, Bitsy and Walter take her to their doctor, who recommends a specialist. The specialist believes that the headaches are caused by tension, by anxiety, by depression. He is sure that they are not your usual migraines, although the symptoms are the same. One night, I am sitting up in bed reading the current issue of People magazine. I had to buy it on the sly and sneak it up to my room. Walter considers it trash and wouldn't think of having a copy in his house. But I have seen Bitsy thumbing through it while waiting online at the Safeway, so I'm not concerned when she knocks on my door.
Surprise, she says. She's carrying a tray with two graham crackers and a cup of cocoa. I feel about 6 years old, especially when I see the marshmallows floating on top. She hands me the tray, then sits on the edge of my bed.
Thanks, I say. I was just thinking about how good a cup of cocoa would taste. Of course I wasn't, but Bitsy believes me. I take a bite of graham cracker, then a sip of cocoa, wondering why Bitsy is sitting on my bed.
Well, she finally says, I wanted to talk to you about your mother.
What about her? I ask.
She's under a lot of stress.
I know.
And Walter and I don't think she should leave until she's feeling better.
I don't say anything, so Bitsy continues.
We feel responsible for you. We can't send you and Jason home with Gwen this way. She's in a daze. It's all beginning to hit her now. She needs time to mend. So we'd like you to stay a while longer. Bitsy is explaining about my mother as if I am going to give her a hard time about going home. The truth is, Bitsy is right, and I know it. We can't go home with Mom this way. Who would take care of her? What would I do when she gets one of her headaches?
Jason is anxious to get back to school, Bitsy says. So tomorrow I'm taking him over to Aspen. It's a very good elementary school. All of our schools are very good.
Do you know we have more national merit finalists than any other city in the country?
Jason likes to go to school, I say. I think it's a good idea for him.
And then I'll take you over to register at the high school.
I snap to attention and almost spill my cocoa. I don't want to go to school here, I say.
Why not? It's a very good school.
That's not the point.
Then what is? I don't want to go to school this year. I'd rather take the year off. Oh, Davy. You can't do that.
I don't see why not. I'll study at home. I'll learn astronomy. I can keep up.
I know I can. I've thought it all out. And I'll help around the house and I'll babysit for Jason and...
You have to go to school, Bitsy says. You've missed more than a month already. I can tell that her mind is made up. That I have no choice.
So much for my fantasy. How long do you think we'll be staying? I ask.
I can't tell you that. But I have to know, it's important.
I don't know myself, Davy. It depends on your mother. But how can I go to school without knowing how long I'm going to stay?
What does that have to do with it?
Everything. I have to know if I should bother to make friends.
Of course you should make friends, Bitsy says. What kind of question is that?
It's an important question. But I can see that she has no idea what I am talking about. There is no point in trying to explain. When Bitsy has gone back downstairs, I get out of bed and walk down the hall to say goodnight to my mother. I open her door without knocking. She is sitting on the bed, surrounded by old photos. She is holding one of my father. She presses it to her face and says,
"Oh, Adam, I miss you so much."
She begins to weep quietly. I close the door to her room. I don't want her to know I've seen her. Chapter 15. I have only 3 free days before school. I spend each of them in the canyon with Wolf. He always has to leave before 2 o'clock. I figure he has a job. I don't ask him any questions. He doesn't ask me any. I like it that way. Wolf tells me stories about the Anasazi, the ancient ones. They used to live in this canyon, and in the canyons and cliffs all around here. He takes me for a walk and shows me a cliff dwelling. I try to imagine us hundreds of years ago, Tiger and Wolf, living in a cave together. We would make love on rocks that have been warmed by the sunshine. We would raise babies, fat and happy. On the 3rd day, Wolf brings me a book, The First Americans. It is about the history of this area. Thanks, I say. I'll read it and bring it back next week.
No, it's for you to keep, he says.
I open it. On the 1st page, he has written, 2 tiger eyes, who makes me laugh. From Wolf. I look over at him. They are, you know, he says.
What?
Your eyes. They remind me of a tiger's. The way they change color in the light from golden to brown.
When's the last time you saw a tiger? I ask.
I have a cat, he says.
That's close enough.
I laugh, wanting to hug him, wanting him to hug me. But he doesn't, and neither do I.
Thank you for the book, I say, and for being my friend.
It's good to have a friend, he says.
Yes, I know.
On Monday morning, Bitsy insists on accompanying me to Los Alamos High School. She asks me 100 times if I need anything. I tell her I don't, but she slips me $10 just in case. Walter and I want you to have an allowance while you're here. Of course, we'll expect you to help around the house, but you've been very nice about doing that without being asked.
Thanks, I say.
I feel uncomfortable taking money from Bitsy, and decide to discuss the situation with Mom. At the high school, we ask a boy with a calculator strapped to his belt where the office is, and then we take a wrong turn and miss it anyway. Bitsy stops a group of girls and asks again. I look away as if I have nothing to do with any of this. When we get to the office, I want to register as a temporary student, but I am told there is no such thing. They want my records from Atlantic City and a medical history from my doctor. I begin to explain that we don't have my school records because we thought we were here for a visit, when Bitsy produces them from her purse. I'm surprised and confused. Bitsy says,
"We sent for them last week."
I don't know whether to believe her or not. I'm told to have a seat, that a guidance counselor will be with me in a few minutes. Bitsy sits next to me. I don't want her hanging around.
I know you have a lot to do this morning, I say.
I don't know that she has anything to do, but I want to get rid of her. I want to do this on my own.
I haven't got anything to do that can't wait, Bitsy says, smiling.